Our next speaker is Xia Chen from Caltech. She'll be giving the first of two lectures today, and the lecture will be about exactly solvable topological and fracton models as gauge theories. And let me remind you again, please use the Q&A to write your questions. And at the end of the talk, if there is time, we'll also have a verbal Q&A, and you'll have other opportunities to raise your questions later today and in the lecture tomorrow. Okay, Xia, why don't you get started now?
Okay, thank you. So let me share my screen. As Ashwin said, I'll be talking about exactly solvable topological and fractal models, but from a perspective of gauge theory. So I'll be very, very explicit about exactly solvable Hamiltonians, their wave functions, and what are some of the properties. And you might have heard about some of the models, like John mentioned this Torrey-Cole model yesterday. And the other models that I'll be talking about include the two-dimensional symmetry-protected topological model with Z2 symmetry, and also its gauge version called the double Semyon topological order. And another one is the newer model, which people call the XQ model with fractal order, which is a new type of thing that people are looking at nowadays. So I'll try to put the three different models under the whole framework of gauge theory and interpret some of their properties from the gauging perspective and be very explicit about how to do the gauging process. Sorry, I somehow can't get the sharing to start. Let me do it again. Don't know why. Sorry, give me a minute. It's So one thing I did is to share a link on Slack, on the Slack channel under Topo Fracton. You should see a link, and that link is an online version of my lecture note, and it will be synced in real time. So the idea is that I do plan to share a screen, but with that link, you'll be able to scroll back and forth on your own computer to see previous pages of my lecture note if you want to. But my sharing should work. So let me try again. Don't know what's going on. Sorry. Very sorry about this. Oh, okay. Now it's coming up. Sorry. Okay. Good. Okay. All right. Very good. Right. So so this is a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. First is a brief review of Torrey-Cole. It's very nice that John already mentioned the basic properties of Torrey-Cole yesterday. So I'll just remind you of it and add something on top of that. And then I'll move on to talk about Torrey-Cole, how to interpret as a gauge theory and how to get it from gauging something, from gauging a very trivial, very simple Ising model, and then how to do step-by-step procedure to obtain a Torrey-Cole as from the gauging process. So hopefully I'll be able to finish these three today. And then tomorrow I'll be dealing with more complicated models, including the double Semyon model from gauging a symmetry-protected topological model, and then talk about some generic properties of symmetry-protected topological models, and also the fractal model of X-cube. Okay, we'll see how we can do. All right, so let's get started with Torrey-Cole. As John mentioned, Torrey-Cole is most easily defined if you put degrees of freedom on the edges of the square lattice. So each blue dot is what we call a qubit. It's a two-level system with 0 and 1 basis state. And I'll use the tall symbol to denote this qubit on the edge. Okay, and then this will be the standard notation for the gauge field degrees of freedom throughout my lecture. It will be tall. Okay, we'll reserve sigma for something else. Okay. And John didn't really mention the Hamiltonian, so let me write down the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian involves two type of terms. One is the so-called vertex term, and the vertex term is centered on a vertex and involves four of these degrees of freedom, and it takes the form of tau z, tau z, tau z, tau z, four tau z's multiplied together. Okay, and the other one is the Plaquette term. The Plaquette term involves four taus around the Plaquette, and the four terms are like tau x, tau x, tau x, tau x. And it's of course repeated all over the lattice. And the nice thing is that all the Hamiltonian terms commute, and you can solve for the ground states exactly. And one very nice thing about toric code is that there's a nice picture about the ground state wave function if we interpret the zero and one state as some kind of Z2 string. So one is the existence of a string on the link, zero is non-existence of the string. And under that interpretation, we can think of the wave function as configurations of closed loops. And moreover, the wave function, I think John also wrote this down in his lecture note yesterday, it will be a summation, equal weight superposition of all the closed loop configurations on the square lattice. So things get more complicated if we put it on a torus when we have non-trivial cycles going through the system. Then there are four ground states. One of the ground states is a configuration of all closed loops, but with no big circles along either the x or y direction. Of course, when I say that, I need to be careful because these big loops, these strings, basically they're Z2 valued. So it's actually allowed to have an even number of big loops in either direction, in x direction or y direction. But when I say that there are no big loops, I mean no odd number of big loops in either direction. So that's one of the ground state. And you can imagine what the other three are like. The other three would have an odd number of big loops in either x or y direction, or it has big loops in both directions. Okay, so those are the four degenerate ground states. And the four degenerate ground states, they can be mapped into each other by basically drawing single strings along the big loop, right? So if I draw a string, using the tau x operator, like this, tau x, tau x, tau x, tau x, tau x, that will create one big loop along one of the directions. And I can do this in the other direction as well. And similarly, tau x, tau x, tau x along the whole line. And that would give me, that would allow me to map between the four degenerate ground states of the toric code. Okay? And a different set of logical operator which allows me to do something to the ground state is to do another big string operator, but slightly shifted. Let me take the dotted blue line and apply a bunch of tau z operator whenever the blue dotted blue line crosses the edges, and apply it all across in the vertical direction. That would allow me to measure whether I have an even or odd number of big loops in the horizontal.
I can see you writing on the active link. Okay, now it just updated. But for a few minutes, we were not seeing it updated in the screen, the Zoom screen. But I think it's okay now. Maybe it's fine.
Oh,
now.
So the Zoom screen, it should be real time, right?
Yeah, it should be.
Okay. So the link I sent, that one has a bit of delay.
Yeah, but actually I saw it on the delayed screen first, on the link screen first before I saw it on the Zoom. I'm not sure why, but anyway, go on. If it happens again, I'll just let you know.
Yeah, just stop me and I'll wait a bit.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Right, so if I do this on the dotted line, the dotted blue line with tau z operator, it will allow me to measure whether I have an even number or odd number of big loops in the horizontal direction. So that takes different eigenvalues on the four sets of eigenstates. And similarly, I can do things in the horizontal direction. So I would say that the dotted line is along the edges of the dual lattice. And that is something that's going to show up again in later models. That's why I want to go through all these details. So if I do tau z again, horizontal direction, it will allow me to measure the even oddness of big loop in the vertical direction. And again, get eigenvalues of plus minus one on different eigenstates. So these are what we call the logical operator because they take different eigenvalues or map different ground state to each other within the degenerate ground space. Okay, and of course, the next interesting feature of toric code is when we try to make excitations, right? So we can apply loop operator, which map ground state to ground state, but it will also be interesting if we apply not just a closed loop operator, but apply an open string. And this I think John mentioned yesterday as well. So if we apply a red string like this, and do of course tau x along the length of the string, then the ground state will remain in the ground state along the length of the string, but at the end point of the string, at the end points of the string, we will have excitations. So we'll have one excitation here, the other excitation here, and we will call this, sorry, the E excitation, the electric excitation.
Shia, again, I'm not seeing you writing on the screen, on the Zoom screen. Ah, thanks, perfect. Yeah, I see it now. I think it was just below on the page.
Okay. I should delay my voice by a certain amount. Right, so the E excitation will be made at the end of a tau x string operator. And that corresponds to, of course, the green Hamiltonian term, the green Hamiltonian term being violated at each of these vertex because the string operator doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian term over there. And similarly, I can do a string operator along the edges of the dual lattice along, let's say, the dotted blue line and make excitations in the plaquettes at the end. And this we call a magnetic excitation, or denoted as M. And the interesting feature of between E and M is that we can do something called braiding. That is, we can create a pair of E excitation and bring and create a pair of M excitation, and then bring one of the M excitation around one of the E excitation, and finally annihilate all of the pair of M excitation. And this, compared with the situation, if we just have a pair of E excitation, if we compare these two processes, we'll see that it gives you the same wave function, but the two states differ by a minus sign. The minus sign exactly comes from when we apply these tau z operator along the blue dashed line on top of this red line, and there's a minus anti-commutation relation coming up. So this is one of the most essential properties of topological order, where we have fractional excitations braiding around each other and giving rise to, in the simplest case, just a phase factor. Okay. And in general, when we look at the topological order where fractional excitations are created in this way, as a pair out of vacuum, but then we can separate them in space, one at this point, one at that point, then there are two things we can do to to extract the basic universal topological feature from manipulating these fractional excitations. One is called the exchange and the other is braiding. So let me try to draw pictures of how in general we can extract exchange and braiding statistics given all kinds of topological models and all kinds of fractional excitation, not just for this particular example. Okay, so the exchange process, well, pictorically we all know what exchange means. Exchange means you have two quasi-particles that belong to the same species and you exchange them, right? But operationally, when we are on a lattice, when we have something like an exactly solvable lattice model, where we can do explicit computation to try to extract this phase factor, we can do it in the following process. We can first take one particle and move it up to here. So this is step one. And we have the other particle here. So originally the two particles are separated at a distance, one on the left, one on the right, and then we move the first one out of the way to the side. And then we take the second one to the location of the first one in the second step. And thirdly, we can move the first particle back and then to the right-hand side. So it's separated into three steps. So in these three steps, we have finished the process of exchange while we never bring these two particles very close to each other because we move the first one out of the way while we bring the second one to the left. And when I draw these pictures, I draw the trajectories slightly apart from each other. But literally, when you say do the calculation on the lattice, they exactly lie on top of each other. And I'm drawing them apart just to show you the process because they should be separated in time. But on the lattice, in spatial direction, they lie exactly on top of each other. So in particular, this region and this vertical region and this horizontal region, everything should just lie exactly on top of each other. Okay, and the path is one way and the reverse way should exactly cancel each other. And that's how we get the statistics out. And the second process is called braiding. And to do braiding, we basically do the process that's shown above, where we create a pair of one species of the particle, and then we create a pair of the other species of the particle. Then we bring the second pair around one of the first pair, and then annihilate, so the second pair disappears. But then we can do the other process to bring the black pair also back together. So you see that in the end, we don't have excitation left and everything will be annihilated. But the crucial part is of course at the intersection, where the intersection you see that they overlap in different order, meaning that the two different loops are actually linked. Okay, and if we want to calculate the statistics, we can use this to divide the process where we have a black loop, the same black loop, and then we have the same green loop, but they're collapsed like that. They're not linked. So if we divide these two processes, we should get the braiding statistics. Okay. And I'm spelling out all these details because when we talk about the symmetry protected topological phase and its gauge version, the other type of topological order tomorrow, I'll expect, I won't do this exact braiding and exchange process in class, but it should in principle be you should be able to do the computation yourself, where you take the string operator and follow the steps and extract the statistics from there and see that this indeed gives you something different from the toric hole that I'm talking about today. All right, so this is just a very brief review of Toric Code. I hope everything's clear. And then I'll be ready to move on to part two. Oops. Which is about Toric Code as gauge theory. So Toric Code is, the name is the naming of it comes from a sort of computer science perspective that it is a code, and it's because it's used as a quantum error correction code. But from the condensed matter or even high energy perspective, it's called the Z2 gauge theory. And so I'll try to explain the terminology, why it is called a Z2 gauge theory. And the name gauge theory, if for physics student, the first place you learn about gauge theory is probably from electromagnetism, from ENM, from classical ENM. And if you recall that in classical ENM, we have Maxwell's equation, classical ENM. We have Maxwell's equation written in terms of electric field, magnetic field. But then what we did is instead of directly solving Maxwell's equation, we introduce the vector potentials, where we say, okay, the magnetic field is, let's say, it's the curl of some fictitious vector potential, and the electric field, we can write it as, well, gradient of a static potential minus the time derivative of the vector potential. So this is, everything is just classical ENM. Just trying to remind everybody what a gauge symmetry looks like when you first see it in a physics class. And this was introduced as a convenience for solving the classical ENM equation, but of course it comes with a redundancy. It comes with some annoyance because the A and phi field, they're not unique. It turns out that A and phi field can undergo something called a gauge transformation, like this, where we change the vector potential by the spatial gradient of a function f, and the phi field by the time derivative of the function f. And of course, f here is a function of space and time. And under all kinds of such transformations, what we can see is that the E and B field remain invariant, and that's why we say it's a symmetry of the classical ENM theory, because Maxwell's equations don't change at all. So this is just some redundancy that we have by introducing the A and phi field. And the name gauge fields is from the name, it's not very easy to tell what it means, but when I see gauge field, I always just replace the word gauge, by the word local. So when we say gauge transformation, we mean that the transformation can be applied locally, in particular in the transformation that I wrote down above, if we take f to take non-zero value only in or a non-constant value only in a very small part of the spatial space-time region, then the transformation will be concentrated within that region, right? In particular, we can shrink f down to a delta function, then the transformation will be literally just focused on that point. So gauge transformation here just means that I can make that transformation local, concentrated at a point, and moreover, I can make that transformation different from point to point because I can choose f to be dependent on space and time. So this is the local symmetry and local transformation of classical ENM, which is why we call it a gauge transformation. And correspondingly, we call the vector potential and the phi field the gauge fields. Okay, so this is the classical version of the story. But now we're in quantum mechanical world, and we want to formulate a quantum version of ENM. And moreover, we'll try to do it on lattice because the whole lecture, and especially target code and all the other discrete models that I'll be talking about, are formulated on lattice. So let's try to put this electromagnetic theory into a quantum version, and moreover, onto the lattice. So the first thing we do is a lattice quantum version of ENM. Is of course to change the fields, the degrees of freedom, into operators. Now, instead of just having electric field and magnetic field and vector potentials, we think of them as operators, and in particular, in the lattice version of quantum ENM, the degrees of freedom, we can think of them as rotors. So we'll have one rotor degree of freedom per edge on each link of the lattice, very similar to what we have in the target code model.
And as a rotor, do you have to move the screen a little bit to see that?
Because it's delayed.
Okay. Yeah, now I see it.
Okay. Okay. So as a rotor degree of freedom, there are two conjugate bases. One is the phase angle of the rotor, where it points to, and the other is the angular momentum. So the phase degree of freedom takes value in 0 and 2 pi, and we choose it to be a periodic rotor, so 2 pi is the same as 0. And the other one is angular momentum, which takes value in integers. And correspondingly, in the quantum version of electromagnetism, the phase angle is correspond to the vector potential degree of freedom, and the angular momentum correspond to the electric field. Okay, and because we're putting these on a lattice, so naturally these quantities carries with it a direction. It just points in the direction of the edges. That degree of freedom lies up. And so for each rotor degree of freedom, it can be described in angular momentum basis, or it can be described in a rotor basis. And moreover, as a quantum degree of freedom, what happens is that the electric field and vector potential as a dual set of variables, they don't commute anymore. And the commutate is a very nice commutation relation, where it says there's a minus I factor. So this is basically how we set up quantum ENM. So then let's see how the gauge symmetry is manifested in this lattice quantum version of ENM. So if you notice that we have broken down the space-time description into a spatial description by putting things especially on a lattice. So we don't have Lorentz symmetry anymore. This is something we give up, at least on the phase level, when try to put the theory on a lattice. And because of that, we just focus on the spatial part of the gauge transformation. We can do some gauge fixing, and then we can just say, okay, let's just focus on the spatial part of the gauge transformation, where we take the vector gauge potential and transform it by the spatial derivative of an arbitrary function. And here, of course, this function will be a function of space only, this f. Okay. And that's how gauge symmetry will be implemented on these quantum degrees of freedom as the change of vector potential. And in particular, we can choose this function f to be, let's say, exactly non-zero only on a point to delta r or not. Let's say just it takes non-zero value only at a particular point at r naught, and everywhere else it's zero. And if we do that, What happens is that we only change the A field going from this point to a neighboring point. So when I write R0 and R1, I mean, this is an edge pointing from R0 to a neighboring point that I call R1. And I'll change the vector potential that lies on this edge by the spatial derivative of f, which is, of course, just f0, because I've chosen it to be a delta function concentrated at this point. And in such a transformation, if we realize that we can use now the fact that the E field and A field are no longer commuting variables, the E field and A field have non-trivial commutation relation, which is given here, which means that I can rotate the A field by using some operator made out of the E field. I can write down an operator using the E operator such that to implement a transformation that looks like this. And the transformation that I can write down is a transformation that's localized around the R0 point, and it takes in the parameter of F0. And it's a unitary operator. It's a unitary transformation that's going to implement the symmetry, and it's a product of a bunch of exponentials of the E field on the edges that points from R0 to its nearest neighbor point of R1. Okay, so it's a product of all such nearest neighbor points and the edges pointing out of from the point. So if this is R0, then we'll have a bunch of R1s. And the operator will be a product of these exponentials over all these edges. And if we notice that, remember that the A field takes value in 0 and 2 pi because this is a rotor degree of freedom. And so its transformation given by, in this particular case, by the F0 also takes value in 0 to 2 pi. So that this U labeled by F0, it's a unitary operator. And it's well-defined because this E field takes value in integer. So when F0 changes by 2 pi, this is the same operator. So it's well-defined. And moreover, this U operator forms a group of U1. Forms a U1 group. And the parameter is, of course, given by this F0. And there's one such operator per each lattice side of R0. And this is exactly what we mean by gauge symmetry, gauge transformation, because you can apply different transformation on different lattice points just by choosing different function of f. Here we have chosen it to be a delta function, so it's exactly concentrated around one point, but you can choose different functions. You can choose f to be dependent on different points in different ways. And then at each point, will have a symmetry group of U1. And this is what we call a U1 gauge symmetry. So whatever theory we write down on this lattice, we'll be using these rotor degrees of freedom and then requiring that the theory have satisfied all these local symmetry transformations. Of course, this is a very big group of symmetry transformation, and the very non-trivial properties will come from that. And if we go back to continuum, we'll see that this gauge transformation, this U, will roughly take the form of an integration where we integrate the E field over a little circle, over a little sphere surrounding the R0 point, And this is exactly saying that if we want to enforce the gauge symmetry, if we want to set U R naught equal to one at every point for whatever F naught, then this is equivalent to imposing the condition that the divergence of E has to be zero at this point as well. So this is just saying that imposing gauge symmetry is equivalent to saying that we satisfy Gauss's law in the quantum version of electromagnetism. Okay, no objections? And now we can move on. All right. So this is the U1 version of the story. And I went to the U1 version of the story because that's the story that we learned in E&M. And now we've taken it to be a quantum version. And but in Torrey code, there's no U1 degrees of freedom. Everything is Z2. And that's because we have broken down the U1 symmetry group, the U1 gauge symmetry group down to Z2. And let's see how that works. So if we break down the U1 to Z2. So physically, how that's implemented is, of course, if we take a metal, say, to an insulator, where the matter field spontaneously breaks the Z2, breaks the U1 symmetry to Z2, and then if we can couple it to a U1 gauge field, then the gauge field will be broken down to Z2 as well. But mathematically, here that's not deal with the physical origin of this breaking down of the symmetry, but just say that originally we have the rotor degrees of freedom to describe the U1 gauge field, and now we break it down to Z2. Then what happens is that originally we have the phase variable, which takes continuous value between 0 and 2 pi, and now it only takes value of 0 and pi. And originally we have this integer value describing the angular momentum, and now it's just broken down to 0 and 1, or in another way of saying it's integer mod 2. This is integer mod 2. And by changing variables like this, we'll effectively break the U1 gauge symmetry down to Z2. So here, once we have done that, it actually become easier or more convenient not directly talk about A and E, but talk about their exponentials. So we'll be talking about exponentials like this, e to the ia and e to the pi ie. And we'll see that e to the ia takes value in plus 1 and minus 1, and e to the pi ie takes value in plus 1 and minus 1 as well. And moreover, we can check using the commutation relation between E and E that these exponentials, they anti-commute. Which is saying that exactly this rotor degrees of freedom become the qubit degrees of freedom that we have in a Torrey code. And this, the exponential of vector potential and exponential of electric field exactly becomes the tau x and tau z degrees operator. So the e to the ia operator becomes tau x, and the e to the ie operator becomes tau z.
Actually, can I interrupt for just a second? Maybe we can take a couple of questions that are on the chat. So one question was, can you clarify the statement that the physical states are invariant under gauge transformations is equivalent to divergence of E is zero? That was one of the questions. Another thing is, maybe I can just mention it now. Is there something we can do to make the Zoom screen update more frequently? I don't know, maybe just moving the page up and down or something. I don't know. That's something we'll have to experiment in, because I think most people are actually following on this, the OneDrive link.
I can try to find a wire to connect my iPad to my computer. Maybe that helps. Tomorrow, I won't be able to do it now.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. So maybe we'll just answer the question and then we can move on. And actually, I'm following on the OneDrive, and it's been pretty good for me. So.
Okay, it's good. I have that link. Yeah, sorry about this.
Yeah. No worries.
Right. Sorry. The question is the relation between gauge symmetry and Gauss's law, right?
Right. That's right.
Right. So it's I put the screen back to this part, and right. So here. Right. So the gauge symmetry is, well, in the quantum version, it's implemented by this unitary operator, which is basically summing over the electric field coming out from this point and then taking an exponential of it. So if we require this transformation to be equal to one always, then that means the exponential has to be zero. So this integration of electric field over this little sphere should be zero. And then if we, then it becomes the fact that if we're in the continuous space, that means that we have the divergence to be zero at that point. Does that answer the question? Did I just jump steps here? Maybe I confused people by jumping the steps.
I think that was good. One suggestion I got from Brandon is that just move your screen up and down more frequently and maybe it'll refresh. So yeah, but let's move on. Yes, thanks.
Okay. Okay, so, right. So now we break down the U1 group down to Z2 and we reduce the rotor degrees of freedom to qubit, and the exponential of the vector potential and electric field becomes the tau x and tau z operator that we see in Tari code, and then we can make the connection. And in particular, let's take the Hamiltonian term, if you remember, that we have in Tari code, which looks like this, tau z, and the other one on a plaquette of the form tau x, and see how, what was their interpretation in a gauge theory. So the first one, it should be obvious because the first one is in terms of tau z, and it originates from one point, right? It's like everything radiating out from that point. So if we replace the tau z by e to the I e, we see that this is e to the I pi sum over this electric field emanating from that point. And here, because everything is z2, so it actually doesn't matter which direction it points to, so I'm not even bothering with the plus minus sign. But as a U1 gauge field, you would mind about the direction of the edge. Here, as z2, it doesn't really matter. So we can just sum over all these electric field and take the exponential of e to the I pi, and that gives me this vertex term. And then it's easy to see that this is exactly the gauge symmetry term. Right? This we write as the UV, which exactly corresponds to the UR0 one I wrote down for the U1 gauge theory. So this is the Z2 version of the gauge symmetry. And the next one, the tau x operator, we replace it as e to the I sum over A. And again, because this is Z2, so I don't need to worry about the direction of the edges. I'm just summing over everything around the single plaquette. And so this is the other term. And we see that if we, in the U1 version of the theory, usually what we do is to take this term and its conjugate and sum them together, and then we get something like cosine sum over A, right? And here, because everything's Z2, so we don't need to worry about it. This is already Hermitian. But for U1, we want to take the Hermitian conjugate and sum them and get a cosine term. But then you can see that, do this. On the lattice, the sum over a plaquette is exactly the flux that comes from the plaquette. So this is enforcing the condition that we have zero flux, or in the continuum, we have zero magnetic field in the system. So toric code is a version of Z2 gauge theory where we enforce the zero magnetic field condition in the ground state. And correspondingly, we can have the same theory in a U1. Of course, the U1 one will be slightly a little bit more complicated because there will be gapless degrees of freedom. Okay, so this is basically why we call toric code a Z2 gauge theory, where the name comes from. The name basically comes from this term, where you impose Z2 gauge symmetry, but then the significance of the second term is to make sure that we don't just satisfy the Z2 gauge symmetry in a trivial way, which people usually say in a confined way. Here, the second term is to ensure that we satisfy the gauge symmetry in a deconfined way, so we can have deconfined electric charge excitation and flux excitation. Okay, so I have half an hour, right? Okay, so this is just to set up the terminology to explain why toric code is called some kind of Z2 gauge theory, why there's a gauge theory, why there's a gauge symmetry inside. And next I want to talk about why how to get toric code from a process called gauging. And you have probably heard about this word many times in Chong Wang's talk. And if you're already comfortable there, this is probably too basic for you. But I want to be very pedagogical and spell out the steps that we implement to do gauging on a lattice in terms of exactly solver models, so that we can use it to apply to a more general class of models and see how the process can give rise to different either topological order or fractal order, which we'll get to tomorrow. So toric code from gauging. And in particular, we'll get toric code by gauging something that's very, very simple, which is the Ising paramagnet. And this is the Ising paramagnet that is probably the first model you learn in condensed matter, which for now, I'll take it to be a square lattice. So let me get a picture of it. We'll put everything on square lattice again, although the whole process doesn't depend that much lattice, and actually tomorrow we'll switch to the triangular lattice just because the SPT model, the symmetry protected topological model, is easier to describe a triangular lattice. But for today, I'll just be on the square lattice. Okay, can you see the figure? Okay. Okay, so here I have a square lattice, and as you can see, I have two sets of things. One is the blue dots on each lattice side, and that will be my matter. So the blue dots are matter degrees of freedom, and this will be the spins in the Ising paramagnet, or in whatever phase it is in. And then the yellow diamond, these will be my gauge field. And I'll explain how they're coupled later. But for now, let's just pretend there's only matter, and the matter, I'll denote it by sigma. And that's why I have been reserving the notation of sigma. And for gauge field, I continue to use the notation of tau. So the Ising paramagnet, or in general, the transverse field Ising model, it's easy to write down their Hamiltonian. Usually we have an Ising term, which is like sigma z on nearest neighbor pairs. And we might have a minus sign. And we have a coupling constant of J. And then on top of that, we can have a transverse field. Okay, so this is the standard transverse field Ising model. And one important property about this transverse field Ising model is that it is invariant under a Z2 symmetry, which is the tensor product of all sigma x. This is a Z2 symmetry, and all the coupling is invariant under that. And let's first consider the case where we're in the paramagnetic phase, which is B much larger than J, or even in the limit where we set J directly equal to zero. If we want to do things exactly, then we'll just set J directly equal to zero. And in this limit, we know the physics. The physics is that pretty much everything is just pointing in the transverse field direction. So the ground state will be a tensor product of all the spins in the x direction. And there's in the limit where J is equal to zero, there's no entanglement. Everything cannot be even simpler. This is just the simplest model you can imagine. And then our goal is, of course, to gauge it. And what do we mean by gauge it? By trying to gauge it, what we mean is that we want to make the model to have local symmetry, right? To have gauge symmetry, to have local Z2 symmetry. Originally, the model has global Z2 symmetry. And we want to have a symmetry and that's local, meaning that we can choose to apply here or there, and we have a very big symmetry group. So this model, as it stands, the transverse field Ising model as it stands, is not immediately local Z2 symmetric. For example, we cannot just apply Z2 symmetry on one of the lattice side here, because that the all the Ising coupling term would anti-commute with it. So this is a problem. So we need to do something in order to promote the global symmetry into a local Z2 gauge symmetry. And the thing we do, of course, is to add a gauge field. Here we add all these yellow diamonds, and the yellow diamonds, we introduce them and we couple them to the matter degrees of freedom in a certain way so that we can promote the global symmetry into local Z2 symmetries. Okay, so let's see how we do that. So the gauge degree of freedom, and because here we're talking about Z2 symmetry and we want to end up with a Z2 gauge theory, the tau degrees of freedom are again qubits. And in general, this is true that if we want to gauge a system with some symmetry, we put in a degree of freedom that matches the symmetry group in this way. So we put them in a way that's between on the edges between every pair of nearest neighbor spins. And the reason we're doing that is because the thing we want to deal with when we try to promote the global symmetry is to make sure that all the Ising coupling terms will be invariant. Right? So we'll modify the Ising coupling terms in a certain way to make sure everything's gauge symmetric. But first we need to define what is gauge symmetric. What is the gauge symmetry that we're talking about? So the gauge symmetry would be some Z2 symmetry that acts only locally. And here, the gauge symmetry will be centered around each lattice point. And at each lattice point, we have a sigma x. But then we also have all the tau x around it. And this is a unitary operator. It's a Z2 operator, squares into identity. So this is a legitimate local Z2 symmetry operation. And this will give us the gauge symmetry. And indeed, if you reinterpret it using the electric field correspondence that we had before, we see that this is equivalent to e to the I pi, sum over the electric field coming out of this point. And moreover, we had another term, we write minus sign here. We had another NV, which is the charge on set, where we have defined the sigma x as e to the I pi NV, where NV is, in a sense, the Z2 charge on that lattice side. So you see that by imposing gauge symmetry at the site, what we're literally requiring is that the sum over E is equal to the charge on the site. Of course, everything is mod 2 here. But this is just the Z2 version of Gauss's law at this point, but in the presence of matter. If we, previously, when we're talking about electromagnetism, we talk about it in the absence of matter. That's why we have the divergence of E or the sum over E to be zero. Here we have matter. We have something that carries charge. So the sum over E will be equal to the charge on the lattice side. Okay, so this is the first step. This is to define what is the Z2 symmetry. And then we want to modify the Hamiltonian terms in such a way that it is invariant under this symmetry. So to do this, we notice that for the transverse field term, we don't need to do anything. This is already symmetric. But we need to do something to the Ising term. And the way we deal with the Ising term is to do something people would call the minimum coupling, which is to take sigma z, and then put a tau z in between. And as long as we do that, you can check that all these kind of terms will be invariant under all the gauge symmetries, under the gauge symmetry centered at all the lattice points in the system. So now we're ready to write down the gauged Hamiltonian. So we take the Ising Hamiltonian and then we make a gauge version of it. So first thing we do is to modify the Ising coupling term like this. And the transverse field term, we don't even need to touch it, we just leave it like that. And then we need to do something like we did for toric-coupled. In toric-coupled, remember there's a flux term which enforces that the magnetic field in the ground state is zero, or the flux through every plaquette will be zero. Here we have a similar condition, and this will be implemented by defining a flux term, very similar as in toric-coupled case. We'll have tau z term. And of course, we sum over all these kind of terms around the plaquette. And you can notice that this term can actually be obtained by taking the Ising coupling term, the modified Ising coupling term, and multiply them around this plaquette. And when we multiply all these minimum coupling terms, the Ising coupling terms around the plaquette, the matter field actually disappears. The matter field squares into identity, and we're only left with a pure gauge term that satisfies the gauge symmetry. Right. Okay, and as a last step, we can put the gauge symmetry into the Hamiltonian, so to enforce the gauge symmetry as an energetic condition, rather than just saying the Hilbert space has to be like that, so that we can really think of the Hamilton of the system as local degrees of freedom with local coupling. And then with all these set of terms, we have successfully gauged the Ising model into a gauge model. I guess there's 15 minutes left, and I'll probably use 30 minutes.
Yeah, there are 15 minutes left. Yeah, but no, go ahead. Do as you please. We can either take questions now, or if you want to go a little further and then take questions.
Yeah, I still have something to cover, so I'll try to finish that before I take questions. Thank you. Right, so let's see now what happens. How do we get toric code from here? Well, I mentioned that to get toric code, we want to be in the paramagnetic phase, right? Or in extreme, let's just set J equal to zero. It's most convenient. And with J equal to zero, the Ising model is exactly solvable. Everything's so simple. And we'll see that we get exactly solvable gauge model as well. So we set J equal to zero. So this term disappears. Very nice. And the rest of the term, it's very easy to see how that's connected to toric code because, first of all the terms commute with each other. Okay. The first two terms commute with the third because they satisfy gauge symmetry, and moreover, they also commute among themselves. So the ground state is exactly solvable. And this term is particularly simple. This is just polarizing the matter field in the x direction. And in particular, we can just decouple that. And or in another way saying that I integrate out the matter field. Maybe that's not exactly the meaning when people say integrate out, but here we can, in a sense, remove the matter degrees of freedom by just setting the Ising spins to be polarized in the x direction, so satisfying all the sigma x term. So the sigma x, you can just replace it by one. And then you can see that the Hamiltonian, where sigma x is set equal to one, goes back to the toric code Hamiltonian, goes back exactly to the toric code Hamiltonian, right? Because we just get rid of this one in the middle and goes back exactly to the toric code Hamiltonian. Okay, so, right. But of course, there's nothing fundamentally different between this gauge model and the toric code model. In particular, we should be able to see all the features of a Z2 gauge theory from this HG already. For example, let's try to see how we can get the fractional excitations from this gauge model and how to see their statistics. Actually, it's very similar to the exact toric code model. Right, so in the toric code model, we had two kinds of excitations, the electric charge excitation and the magnetic flux excitation. Now we're going to see why they're called these names. The electric charge excitation, it goes along the edges of the lattice, and it goes like this, for example. And here, we can define the string operator like this. We still have tau x on the edges on all the gauge degree of freedom. And then at the end, we can put a sigma x here. Did I do things correctly? Sorry. Oh, sorry. I did it. Sorry. I messed things up. Let me redo this. Sorry. So we can have tau z on the edges, and then we can have sigma z at the vertices. So this whole string will satisfy the gauge constraint everywhere. But you can see what it does. It creates a symmetry charge at the ends with the sigma z string, with the sigma z operator, right? The sigma z will anti-commute with the local symmetry and create a symmetry charge, but then it does it in a way that's still consistent with Gauss's law. So this is why we call it electric charge excitation. This is the E excitation. On the other hand, we can apply a string operator on the dual lattice along the dashed blue line and do a bunch of tau x. And this would anti-commute with the Plaquette operator at the two ends. And we mentioned the Plaquette operator makes sure that there's no flux at the end or no magnetic field in each of the Plaquette. But here, because they're violated, so we're actually creating the M excitation at the end. Okay. So very simply, we can see that how the string operating the toric-cold version matches with the string operating this Ising theory gauge version, and they're literally equivalent to each other. And now you can take these string operators and do the process that I described above to compute the grading and self-statistics of the excitations, and you will see that both E and M are bosonic, meaning that if we do the exchange, we don't get an extra phase factor. And this is very simple to see because the string operators are very easy, very simple. They're just sigma x and tau x and tau z. So there's obviously no extra phase factors coming out. But then between E and M, there's a braiding phase factor of minus one. And this braiding phase factor is exactly the Aharonov Bohm effect between a charge and a flux. So if we have literally an electric charge and we bring it around the flux, we have a flux like this and we bring an electric charge around it, we'll accumulate a phase factor of e to the I phi. And here, because everything's broken down to Z2, so we can't get an arbitrary phase factor, but we will only get a phase factor of e to the I pi. So this is the AB effect between a gauge charge and the corresponding gauge flux of the Z2 gauge field. And I'm emphasizing this because we will see how things are different in the symmetry protected version of pretty much the same story, except that we'll take a much more non-trivial version of a paramagnet instead of just an Ising paramagnet where everything's polarized in the x direction. We'll take a much more complicated version, still in two dimension, but the ground state wave function will be entangled. And then there's still a Z2 global Z2 symmetry so that we can apply the same procedure that we're doing here for the Ising paramagnet to that paramagnet, and then get a more complicated version of a topological order, and then we'll see why that becomes a different topological order. Okay, so I have 5 minutes. I guess I'll just stop here, but so let me summarize the things we do in order to gauge a model. First of all, we need to have a model with global symmetry, and we imagine that the degrees of freedom are on some kind of lattice points. And then we introduce gauge degree of freedom onto the edges so that we can couple the Ising term or whatever kind of term you have in your model into a gauge invariant way. And this is consistently doable for whatever term that is global, that has the global symmetry. And this has been shown. So as long as you put the degrees of freedom onto the edges, you can do that. But of course, we'll see something different tomorrow when we talk about fractons, where the symmetry is not a global symmetry, but a different kind of symmetry. And then we'll see how we need to putting the gauge degree of freedom differently in order to promote that different symmetry into a local symmetry. But for global symmetry, this is what we do. We put gauge field onto edges, and then we modify the original Hamiltonian such that it's gauge invariant. And we write down the modified Hamiltonian term. We write down the flux term, which is some pure gauge field term that commutes with the gauge symmetry. And then we can also add the gauge symmetry term into the Hamiltonian. Then we have a gauge model. And that model usually, that model will capture the topological order of the gauge theory, which will actually reflect back on the property of the original model with the global symmetry. Okay, so if you're interested in, if you have time, I have two homework for you. One is actually mentioned by Chong in his talk about duality. It's a 1 plus 1D version of this whole story. The 1D transverse field Ising model, you can try to see how you can gauge it and get the self-dual a relation that Chong mentioned. And the other one is in this 2 plus 1D story of transverse field Ising model, what if we take the other limit, not the B, much larger than J limit? What if we take the limit of J much larger than B? And we all know that in the transverse field Ising model, we get a symmetry breaking phase. And so if we couple the symmetry breaking phase to a gauge field, we should get a Higgs model, right? And you can try to play with the exactly so model, see how things should turn out. So if you set B to zero, you will again get exactly so model, and you can get you can see why in what sense that model is Higgs, how the gauge theory is Higgs. Okay, I'll stop here.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chair. We have a couple of minutes. And I'm actually inclined to take one of the questions that's in the Q&A. I think it's a slightly long question, so maybe you could give a brief answer now if you like, and we could continue this in the Q&A session later. But just to summarize the question, I think it has three parts. So the first part is, we talked about two different things. One is the dual of the Z2 of the dual of the global Z2 Ising model being the Ising gauge theory. And the second thing is gauging the Z2 symmetry of the Ising model, also leading to a Z2 gauge theory. How are these related to one another? And I think the third part of the question was, is there any subtlety in this process when you gauge the, when you do the duality? As there was in Chong's talk in the morning, where the self-duality of the Ising model actually has to be qualified with one side being coupled to a Z2 gauge field. So does something analogous happen when you do the duality in 2 plus 1D between the Ising gauge theory and the Ising model?
Okay, so the first part is about the 2 plus 1D. So they're basically 1 plus 1D part and 2 plus 1D part.
Well, it's all about the 2 plus 1D theories. But in the third part of the question, the analogy was being made to the 1 plus 1D case where there was a subtlety. And is there some similar analogous subtlety appearing in the 2 plus 1D examples?
I suppose Chong mentioned that it's self-dual, but there's a gauge field.
Right. Right.
I see. Okay.
But maybe for today, given the limited amount of time, do you want to comment on the first part, which is there a distinction between gauging the Z2 symmetry and the duality of the Ising model?
Right. So first thing I want to say is that the word dual is can be used in a lot of ways. And I suppose here by dual, so there's a very nice story about duality between Ising model and the gauge theory. If you think about the Ising model as some magnet with domains, and then you map the degrees of freedom onto domain walls. Actually, that's a nice way to do this model and also the SPD model that I talk about tomorrow. But I didn't choose that way because I'm talking about gauging here, because that picture works when you have this domain and domain wall picture of your wave function. If you just have a generic model, let's say some fermions hopping around, this gauging process still works. This gauging process doesn't care about the picture of the wave function. And also, right, so the question is about lattice gauge theory, yes. And in lattice gauge theory, that's also possible that you can do this still. But I want to say that the version I'm talking about today is for generic lattice model, Hamiltonian model on a lattice with global symmetry. And you can implement this procedure for whatever model. Well, whether that's solvable or not, that's another question, but you can try to do this and try to derive something from it. So for the simple Z2 model, they give you the same result. It's the same story, basically. But for other models, there might not be a duality of that sort. But the gauging process should generically work.
Okay, so maybe we should stop over here and thank Shia for a very nice and clear talk. Let me